This is the BBC. For details of our complete range of programmes, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Welcome to the latest global news recorded at 14 hours GMT on Friday, the 24th of November. I'm Claire McDonnell with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service news today. Coming up, Zimbabwe's new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, in his inauguration address, has paid tribute to his ousted predecessor, Robert Mugabe, as father of the nation. And he also had this to say.
Acts of corruption must stop. Where these occur, swift justice must be served.
Also in the podcast, more than 180 people have been killed in an attack on a mosque in Egypt. A South African court has more than doubled the jail sentence of the Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius for murdering his girlfriend.
In South Africa, there's a minimum sentence for murder, which is 15 years. And that's what they've been arguing for, and that's what they got today.
And later...
You're pathetic.
No, I'm not.
You can't really stand up to me.
Yes, I can.
How come you're so confident?
Because I'm not going to listen to you anymore.
A new therapy for schizophrenia that brings the patient face to face with a computer representation of the voices in their heads. But first, to Zimbabwe, where, in front of a packed national sports stadium in Harare, Emmerson Mnangagwa has been appointed the country's third president.
I, Emmerson Dambudzo Mnangagwa, swear that as president of the Republic of Zimbabwe, I will be faithful to Zimbabwe and obey, uphold and defend the Constitution and all other laws of Zimbabwe.
Amid a carnival-like atmosphere in the stadium, thousands sang and danced. And following a 21-gun salute, the country's Air Force performed a flypast. The comedienne Mia Titi was filled with excitement. She said it was a special moment for Zimbabwe.
To our new president, we are very happy. To the general, Mr. Chiwenga, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you so much!
But despite the celebrations, the country's problems remain. The key issue for the president and Zimbabweans nationwide is the country's economy. The government abandoned its currency in 2009 after inflation skyrocketed to just under 80 billion%. And today, unemployment stands at around 90%. Well, in an impassioned and wide-ranging speech, the new 75-year-old leader promised a crackdown on corruption and also promised to focus on the agricultural sector and rebuild the economy.
We'll be predicated on our agriculture, which is the mainstay, and on creating conditions for an investment-led economic recovery that puts a premium on job creation.
Well, our Africa editor, James Copnell, listened to the speech. I asked him for more on its key points.
I think he set out to hit all the right notes in terms of talking about reconciliation, in terms of talking about the economy, in terms of talking about building a Zimbabwe for all. There was a very big focus on the economy, whether it was talking about land reform, that controversial land repossession program from the early 2000s in which many white farmers lost their lands. He said, look, we're not going to go back, we're not going to change it, but we will provide compensation to the old farmers and we want the new farmers to be more productive. He talked too about attracting more foreign direct investment. Foreign companies have been nervous about coming into Zimbabwe for some time now. He talks about ending corruption, as we were hearing a little bit earlier, acknowledging really the errors of the current government. But he also had some nice things to say about his predecessor, Robert Mugabe, his role above all in creating Zimbabwe, the liberation struggle and so on. So I think it was a speech very much designed to reassure people both inside and outside the country about the direction he wants to push Zimbabwe. Although, as he said himself, these are just words. None of this matters. It's actions that count.
So can he do it? Can he bring about the change the country clearly so desperately needs?
Well, he's an interesting man to try and bring about change in the sense that he's been part of this governing elite for so long, Mugabe's right-hand man. He's accused of human rights abuses in the 1980s and the Matabeleland massacres. He's accused of repression after the 2008 elections. He denies that. This nickname of the crocodile gives some indication of the fearsome nature of his reputation in Zimbabwe. I do think he is not in the same context as Mugabe was, though. It's pretty clear that Mugabe was very unpopular by the end. But the people coming out to support Mr. Mnangagwa are not all his natural supporters. There are people from all sorts of political parties putting pressure on Zimbabwe to bring about a real change. And Mr. Mnangagwa, of course, would have to drive that. And foreign nations too, foreign businesses and so on, who want to get involved in Zimbabwe but feel nervous about it. So I think he's under pressure to be more consensual in his leadership, certainly, than Mr. Mnangagwa was. And I noticed some opposition politicians commenting after the inauguration ceremony that there was no party rhetoric. It was a national event. And they thought that that was a good first step.
And we've heard people talking on the ground over the last week saying, yes, they're happy that this transition of power is happening, but what about free and fair elections? That's when they will truly believe the country has moved on. So will we see them next year?
We should do. Mr. Mnangagwa made a commitment to elections next year. So any talk of some sort of transitional government bringing in people from different parts of the country seems now less likely. So we should see elections. But those elections will be a very early test of how sincere Mr. Mnangagwa is about bringing about genuine reforms to the country.
Our Africa editor, James Copnell. Now, as we record this podcast, Egyptian state television is saying that militants have killed at least 125 people in an attack on a mosque in the Sinai Peninsula. 120 were wounded. The government in Cairo has declared 3 days of national mourning. I asked our Arab Affairs editor, Alan Johnston, for more details.
Well, reports still coming in from what is quite a remote part of the Sinai Peninsula, a village on the northern coast, not far from the capital, El Arish, the regional capital. But it seems clear that our men have targeted the softest of targets, if you like, a mosque packed with people gathered for Friday prayers, reports of gunfire and the detonation of an explosion and many, many casualties. Unclear exactly why this mosque was singled out. One report suggesting that supporters of the military, perhaps the military themselves, were gathered there. Other suggestions that perhaps this mosque was targeted because it was a place where people of the Sufi sect of Islam, a more moderate sect of Islam, gathered to pray.
And do we know anything more about the militants involved? North Sinai is known as a restive province.
That's right. Sinai is a difficult place, marginalised economically, a fertile ground for people that might want to stir up insurgency. And in recent years, militants there have attached themselves to the Islamic State group. And the army has waged a long, bitter, sometimes brutal campaign against these militants, but they have retained an ability to strike, sometimes with devastating effect, as they appear to have today. We're used to attacks on the military, sometimes 20 or so being killed in one strike, but I can't remember an attack on a mosque like this in Sinai before.
Alan Johnston. The de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, has described Iran's supreme leader as the new Hitler of the Middle East, saying that, as with Hitler, appeasement won't work. He told the New York Times it was ludicrous to suggest his anti-corruption drive was a power grab, since many of those arrested had already pledged allegiance to him. The newspaper says Saudi Arabia is experiencing the most significant reform process anywhere in the Middle East. And if this Arab Spring Saudi style succeeds, it will change the tone and the tenor of Islam across the globe. Mohamed Yahya is from BBC Arabic. He has read the article and he told me more about the Crown Prince's comments.
It's a long piece. It's over 2,700 words, and most of it is focused on his economic and social and political reforms that he's currently doing. And he gave a lot of details about why he's doing it and what he's trying to achieve. He said that the Saudi government coffers has been stolen for a very long time by powerful and influential people, members of the royal family, and he wants to stop this. He estimated that about $100 billion could be taken back from them. And he talked about Islam. I mean, Saudi Arabia is traditionally known as a hub for hardline interpretations of Islam. And he says that he wants to change all of this. He said that the turning point for Saudi Arabia was 1979, the year where the Iranian Revolution happened, the siege of Mecca and the Afghanistan war. And he said since then, the successive Saudi governments leaned towards the hardline interpretations of Islam. And he wants to change all of this. Very ambitious, but he spoke in lots of details about it.
It's in some ways trying to calm things down, but others saying the rhetoric he used in this interview, he called Iran's supreme leader the new Hitler of the Middle East, really ramps up tensions. Why is he using such language? Why does he call him that?
Now, that was the small bit of the New York Times piece when he spoke about foreign policy and the regional conflicts. And it was striking, really, that he chose such harsh language as comparing Ayatollah Khomeini of being like Hitler and even comparing the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran to World War II. And at the same time, he praised Trump and said he was the right person at the right time.
OK, he's got these bold ambitions and he's gone about it in quite a drastic way. How likely is it that he will achieve that goal, as you've just stated, of changing the direction of Islam in his neck of the woods?
Well, all Saudi Arabia observers, almost all of them, agree that it's a very difficult and ambitious plan and that it's full of risks because he alienated some of the people from the religious establishment and alienated some members of his powerful royal family as well.
That's Mohammed Yahya of BBC Arabic speaking to me earlier. Schizophrenia is a complex mental health condition where hallucinations are common. Well, now new research claims those with the condition can benefit from a therapy that brings them face to face with a computer representation of the voices in their heads. The trial, published in the Lancet Psychiatry Journal, suggests that avatar therapy is more effective at reducing hallucinations than supportive counselling. First, let's have a listen to one of those avatars at work.
You're pathetic.
No, I'm not.
You can't really stand up to me.
Yes, I can.
How come you're so confident?
Because I'm not going to listen to you anymore.
Well, Philippa Garrity is a professor of clinical psychology and senior author of the study. Dan Damon asked her how this therapy works.
The way it works is that together with the person who hears voices, we create the avatar. First, we create the voice, the sound of the voice that they hear with very sophisticated software, which brings an experience of hearing the voice very like the voice that they hear inside their head. And then we create a visual image of the face, which is the entity which they think is the source of the voice. We then, what is clever and novel about this, is we then have the situation where a therapist can voice the avatar as well as be a therapist so that they can support the person facing the avatar in a short dialogue. And the goal is to help the person to confront the avatar and take more control and take power away from the voice.
Does it help that it's seen rather than unseen?
Yes, we think it does. Although the voice is very important, and patients have told us that the voice is uncannily like the voice they hear, and that makes it very real, so they feel as if they're communicating with their voice at the time. It helps that they've got a face to look at, which is showing speech sounds, and they can concentrate. And they often feel very frightened of the face and the voice when they first encounter it. And we make it a very supportive process so that they can face it.
And having created the voice, and that was an insulting voice.
Yes.
Does the therapist then gradually turn it towards something that's more supportive, more encouraging?
Yes. We start deliberately with the verbatim speech that the person hears in order to create the conditions of it to be the real experience for the person. And encourage for a couple of sessions, short periods of maybe 7 minutes, people to talk back to the voice, look at the face and stand up to the voice and say they're in control. But then we will shift and acknowledge that the person is behaving differently, that they are responding differently to their voice. And so the avatar will shift to be less insulting, more supportive.
And what's the level of success currently?
Well, what we're publishing today is the results of the first large-scale trial. And what we've shown is that we get a large improvement in the severity of the person's everyday voices. They become less frequent and less distressing. And it's a larger effect than we've seen in other comparable therapies.
Philippa Garrity there, a professor of clinical psychology. You're listening to Global News, the most important stories and the best interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. A reminder that every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World This Week. Here's Ben Wright to tell us what's in the latest edition.
Russia says there is now a real chance to end the civil war in Syria. President Putin is orchestrating talks after 2 years providing military firepower to President Assad. We ask what role Russia seeks in the Middle East. In Zimbabwe, an ageing henchman of Robert Mugabe becomes the new president, so will anything really change? Angela Merkel ended talks to form a coalition in Germany. They might resume, but can she repair her political reputation? A film in India has aroused such passions that death threats are being made against the people involved. Why? And we look up to the skies, where an asteroid from another solar system has been spotted for the first time.
Thanks, Ben. That is all in The World This Week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website. Now to South Africa. The trial of Oscar Pistorius for the murder of his girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp attracted interest from around the world, as well as in his native country. Now a court has substantially increased the jail term imposed on Pistorius. The former Paralympic athlete had been sentenced to 6 years. That has now been raised to 13 years and 5 months. Reeva Steenkamp's parents, June and Barry, said they finally felt they could move on.
I felt that we didn't have justice for Reeva. Why, that's too lenient a sentence. But now we have justice for her.
I just feel that now we can get on with our lives. That it has, everything has come to an end. And I, right from the beginning, always said justice hadn't been served. Today it has.
Well, earlier I spoke to our correspondent Milton Nkosi, who is in Johannesburg, and started by asking him why this court case, at the time, gripped the world.
It's simply because Oscar Pistorius, the man who eventually got convicted of murder here, was a hero. Double amputee at 11 months, and he becomes the fastest runner in the Olympics, running against able-bodied people. He never got a gold for that, but he did fight a long time to compete with able-bodied athletes. And also he won gold medals in the Paralympics. So he was a hero beyond measure. Everyone looked up to him. Here's a man with no legs who could run races and win medals. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, he news just comes out that he fired 4 shots into his bathroom in the middle of the night, killing his model girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp, on Valentine's Day 2013. And that's what made the whole world focus on this trial like no other.
Of course, the prosecutors today successfully argued that the prison sentence was too short because that has been raised substantially. So what was the basis of their argument?
So essentially, what happened with this trial, as you might recall, we were covering it day in, day out. The trial judge, Thokozile Masipa, in the first instance, convicted Oscar Pistorius of culpable homicide or manslaughter and sentenced him to 5 years in prison. The prosecutors found that totally unacceptable. They appealed so that he can be convicted for murder. In South Africa, there's a minimum sentence for murder, which is 15 years. And that's what they've been arguing for, and that's what they got today.
Milton Nkosi in South Africa. The Ukrainian army has reported a marked escalation in fighting in the east of the country amid an apparent power struggle in the rebels' self-declared Luhansk Republic. Jonah Fisher reports.
In the last 2 years, the front line in eastern Ukraine has hardly moved. But the war is not over. According to the Ukrainian military, 5 of its soldiers have died in the last 24 hours, all but one of them in an 8-hour confrontation with rebels that involved both heavy weapons and machine gun fire. In the last few days, the leader of the self-declared Republic of Luhansk appears to have been ousted, with the help of troops from the neighbouring rebel republic of Donetsk.
Jonah Fisher. Now, today is so-called Black Friday, an annual mega retail event marked to coincide with the day after the US holiday of Thanksgiving. Major online retailers promise deals on everything from TVs to smart toasters. And in the US, for the very first time, Kinder Eggs. Kinder Eggs have never been sold in the US because of a 1938 law that prohibits any non-edible objects in sweets. It's made the treats illegal there up until now. Dan Damon spoke to Joe Woss, an illustrator, cartoonist and candy enthusiast whose love of Kinder Eggs got him into trouble with the law.
They are just the most perfect product on the planet. They're delicious chocolate and these wonderful, adorable toys. And so I decided that I'd start bringing those in for my own enjoyment.
But the Kinder Eggs are illegal, or were illegal anyway.
Yes, they were illegal, but I thought, you know, I'm only bringing in, you know, maybe a few chocolates, you know, and toys to enjoy for me, myself, and my family. So I started bringing them in, you know, whenever I would go up to Canada, I'd, you know, maybe get a case or two. And I didn't have too much problem just bringing them right across the border. And then I made a trip to Europe, to Belgium, as a matter of fact. And I decided while I was there, Kinder Eggs are, of course, very prevalent. And so I got about 24 Kinder Eggs and decided I would bring those home. And I made it through Europe, no problem. I made it out of Europe. But when I got to New York, they inspected my bags and they discovered the Kinder Eggs. And I knew I was in trouble because apparently the fine for Kinder Eggs, bringing them in, is $2,500 for each egg. So,
wow, that's quite an expensive chocolate.
It's quite an expensive chocolate. They were nice about it, but slightly sadistic. They said I could keep the toys because what makes them illegal is in U.S., our children by our government are regarded as being extremely dumb. And so they're afraid that the children don't know the difference between toys and edibles. And so they're afraid that children will eat toys. I've never met a child yet who actually would eat a toy and swallow it. But, you know, this is our government believes this. So what makes them illegal is having the toy encased in chocolate. So they said I could keep the toys. I said, thank you. I said, I'll just take them out of the chocolate. And they said, no, you have to eat all the chocolate. And so our the security at the airport basically forced me to eat 24 Kinder Eggs. Thankfully, I didn't get diabetes immediately from it. But they gathered around and watched as I devoured these eggs. And they seemed to get a real sadistic glee out of it, which I got to say, it was a much better punishment than thousands of dollars in fines. But at the same time, they clearly enjoyed it way too much.
Now, this was always the thing that people said about it, that you were not allowed to bring Kinder Eggs, but you can have a gun. If safety is an issue, then Kinder Eggs are more dangerous than guns.
Yes, and had I been smart enough to hide the Kinder Eggs in an automatic rifle, I probably would have gotten them into the United States no problem. And they've had to actually adapt the Kinder Egg to make it safe for our children. So it's not quite the same. Hopefully it'll still bring me the same amount of joy, but if not, I may be back to smuggling these eggs into America.
There's a man who loves his chocolate, Joe Woss, the illustrator who loves Kinder Eggs. In just over 200 days, the world's focus will be centred on Russia when the Football World Cup kicks off there. But where are the 32 nations likely to base themselves? England's favoured location for their base is the small village of Rypina near St. Petersburg. It has a purpose-built training ground and a 4-star Baltic Sea hotel to stay in. Sarah Rainsford has been taking a look around.
Just outside St. Petersburg, a boys' team are getting ready for the World Cup. Not to play, not yet. But it looks like the England squad will be based in their town. And these 10-year-olds are excited.
Do you know anyone from the England team?
Vardy, Kane, Hart.
Who's your favourite player?
Kane, Harry Kane.
Demir tells me he wants to watch the professionals in training.
Is that Premier?
To get some tips and some autographs. This is where the boys hope to see England. It's still a muddy construction site for now, with a potent whiff of wet tarmac. But it's gradually being transformed into a World Cup training ground. And all of this will be inherited by the boys' football school once the tournament's over. Alexander Sinov is their coach.
We'll get a modern pitch with a natural surface, underfloor heating and irrigation. It will really help. The boys can't wait to get on it and play.
But it's not just the sports facilities that have put this place at the top of England's pick list. It's the peace and quiet, and there is plenty of that in Rapina. The team camp is a 45-minute drive from St. Petersburg along the Baltic coast.
Well, it's not quite the Costa del Sol here, but it is pretty gorgeous. There's a long sandy beach and pine trees behind. Not bad for a bit of relaxing, even sunbathing between matches.
The Baltic Sea isn't the warmest sea in the world, though, and apart from the beach, I couldn't find many distractions here. One of the sites is where Lenin once lived and plotted revolution. But these days it's an overgrown square with a warped table tennis table. So the footballers would spend most of their time in the hotel, tucked away in the woods.
So what kind of room's this?
It's a superior room.
I got a tour of it from Kirill, who's been brushing up his English specially.
Well, where... Our service is really nice and on a high level, no matter what people say.
Is there anything you think that would please the English people particularly?
I don't know. I don't know really. Classic English breakfast, maybe. Or tea with milk. I don't know really.
It's all quite brown, definitely functional rather than fancy. It seems the idea is to keep the players focused on the football. There are three restaurants, though, as well as the pool and the spa, so the players shouldn't get too bored if they do end up staying beyond the group stage. Back at the youth team training, these Russian boys think England should manage that. But when I ask them who's going to win this World Cup, most of them are betting on Argentina.
Pretty categorical there. That report from Sarah Rainsford. And that is all from us for now. But an updated version of the Global News podcast will be available for you to download later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. That address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Claire McDonnell, and until next time, goodbye.